This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
5 minutes past the hour of six. I'm Howard Feldman, and this is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Your skin is doing a lot more than deciding whether you look tired on a Monday morning. It's your body's largest organ, the first in line of for defense, and sometimes an early warning system for what is happening inside your body. A rash, a mole, an unusual pigmentation, or even hair loss, can apparently be more than a cosmetic issue. Well, then there's the other side of it. Every week, social media seems to have another miracle product, whether it's collagen or peptides or supplements or gadgets, promising younger, healthier skin, some backed by science and others not so much. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Send us your questions on 061 895 1019. Anything to do with skin, anything to do with some of the issues that you might have or don't have, I don't know, let us know. Anton Myberg, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Nice to be back on the show.
Is it, though?
It's only been a week.
Okay, it has been. It has been. And we've missed you, of course, tremendously. So let's get straight into it, because it's an incredibly big topic. And I didn't realize until we started planning the show how big a topic it is.
Yeah, well, listen, we do know that skin, as you say, is the largest organ in the human body. So, I mean, it's...
And apparently, and this is where I want to kick off...
We cover a lot of space.
Oh, God, we can't. We can't do skin puns.
No skin off my back.
Oh, my word. Skin deep, that's us. Why do doctors often diagnose illness just by looking at someone's skin?
So, you got to remember that the skin is almost like a mirror, because it's a highly vascular, it's a metabolically active organ. And if you've got internal issues like hormonal imbalances or nutritional deficiencies or immune system dysfunctions, these are often triggered by reactions on the surface of your skin. So we as doctors look at the skin because it provides us with a rapid, non-invasive examination, and sometimes it gives us life-saving diagnostic clues. For example, if you've got an autoimmune disease or a systemic condition, like conditions like lupus, sarcoidosis, or inflammatory bowel disease, often you get distinct rashes on the face or on the body. You get bumps or tender nodules. In metabolic and endocrinological diseases like diabetes or thyroid disease, the skin can become dry and itchy. You can develop dark velvet-like patches. That's called acanthosis nigricans. Or you can display very much a sort of slow healing to sores or slower healing of ulcers. And then also looking at things like circulation and your liver function, you can get a yellowish tint to the skin, which is a jaundice. Mm-hmm. Or this could indicate some liver distress or an infection in the liver. But if somebody's got a bluish skin, this can indicate respiratory or a cardiac disease. So even when you look at nutritional things like vitamin deficiencies or things like a lack of zinc can cause an abnormal hair growth or easy bruising. So the skin itself is a huge diagnostic factor for doctors. And I always say to my patients, as soon as you're walking into our room, already we start looking at our patients, start diagnosing.
You made that comment last week.
Just
it's so interesting.
From looking at the patient's skin or the way they walk or how they hold themselves up neurologically,
etc. Skin is a very, very big factor. What about fingernails?
So fingernails are very important because those can help you understand this thing called half and half nails, where you get a white part and a brown part on your nail. And that actually is an indicator of kidney disease or can be an indicator of liver disease. And there's other things like something called clubbing, where you actually get almost like we call them a drumstick fingertip or like a bulbous fingertip, where you get a curved nail where it's bluish and pale, the nail. Or you can get splinter hemorrhages, which are actual little hemorrhages on your nail, which is a sign of infective endocarditis. So this
what is the sign of?
Infective endocarditis.
Right.
So if we go back to the ones we're talking about nail clubbing, it's generally characterized by a rounded, what we call bulbous fingertip, and the nail's then curved down sharply. And it's very much a sign of a chronic low blood oxygen. And we see it in chronic lung conditions, things like lung cancer, conditions like cystic fibrosis or pulmonary fibrosis, as well as certain types of congenital heart diseases. Whereas with people with bluish nails, that's a sign of cyanosis. In other words, your body isn't getting enough oxygen-rich blood being sort of sorted out from the lungs or the hearts. And then another sign, paleness of your fingertips can show that you're either anemic or you've got congestive heart failure.
Is everything fine here? Look, just looking at my fingernails. Good, huh?
Did you go for a manicure today?
Not today, it's the 9 days.
Or maybe you should. Anyway, so going back to splinter hemorrhages, these are tiny red or brownish lines under the nail bed. And that can be caused by damage to capillaries, and that's from an injury, or it can be, as I said, endocarditis, which is an infection in the layer of the heart, an infection of the heart itself. And then lastly, things like yellow nails. Now, yellow nails are very common in smokers because of the damage from or the nicotine or the tar onto the actual, onto the nails. And also it can be a symptom of a respiratory disease like chronic bronchitis. So your nails are very, very diagnostic of what's going on in the person's body.
We're going to come back to you. We're going to take a quick ad break. Send us your questions, 061-895-1019.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
12 minutes past six, I'm Howard Feldman. A very good evening. Bianca says, good evening, Mr. Howard Feldman. Dr. Anton Meiberg, such an important conversation. Thank you so much for having it. And it really is a critical conversation. Let's talk about diabetics. Do they have specific skin problems?
So, I mean, as I've said before, if someone who knows diabetes, then they essentially know the whole medical human body, because people with diabetes, their chronic high blood sugar can end up damaging their blood vessels and their nerves, and that leads to poor circulation, can cause reduced moisture in the skin, and then it also weakens the immunity and the immune system's ability to fight off bacteria and fungi, and makes the skin more prone to severe dryness, itching, and infections. So if they've got a poor circulation and nerve damage, which we call a neuropathy, those damaged blood vessels then reduce the blood and oxygen supply to the skin. This will affect its elasticity and texture, and then it will ultimately affect the natural healing ability of the skin. And then if you've got nerve damage from the diabetes, this impairs your sweat glands and reduces sensation, making it more difficult to feel minor cuts or scrapes that can easily worsen into ulcers. And that's why we often send our patients to podiatrists, because the diabetic patients have got this neuropathy where they actually can't feel nerve damage or pain on their lower feet, and they can cut their feet and have ingrown toenails and not even know. And I mean, with a weakened immune system, with the high blood sugar, your body's much less capable of fighting off bacteria, things like common ones like Staphylococcus or other fungi, and they present with infections, boils, or even athlete's foot. And then a lot of people with diabetes have got this severe dryness of the skin called xerosis, and that, you know, the high sugar levels actually draw out water from the body. And that goes from the surrounding cells because it goes out to dilute the sugar in the body.
Wow.
So, and then you expel it through the urine, and that causes dehydration.
Wow. And that causes dry skin.
And don't forget, most importantly, is insulin resistance. Is those patients get those purplish sort of type of velvety type of tags. They're called acanthosis nigricans. And that's the high levels of insulin in the bloodstream causes buildup of that pigment. And that results in those dark sort of velvety patches on the neck or armpits. So it's very common you see that in your patients. You know, there's either an insulin resistance or diabetes there.
Wow. Okay, and skin signs that should never be ignored?
So I think that's more to do with things like moles, you know, because when moles change in size and shape or color.
Okay, so let's get on to that.
Or even things like sores, like that don't heal, or rapidly spreading rashes, you know, that's very important, because that helps you understand, you know, you're dealing with something that's going to be potentially dramatic or life-changing.
Okay, so let's break this up now. Now let's start talking about different types of ailments. I think if that's the right word I'm using, let's talk about, let's kick off with acne. First of all, I know that we obviously associate acne with teenagehood and hormones, but it seems to me that adult acne has become a lot more common. Is this true?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, and that's because, once again, going back to prolonged chronic stress, hormonal shifts, and what a lot of people do without even realizing it is they use these pore-clogging skincare products So that, together with our dietary habits and all the environmental factors that trigger the excess oil production and inflammation in the skin. So with chronic stress, what do you get? You get an elevated cortisol level. What does that do?
This cortisol thing is up to no good.
It's a bad
it makes us fat. It makes us not sleep. It gives us what now?
So it gives you bad skin, acne, because it stimulates your sebaceous glands in your skin to produce more oil, and that leads to these deep, painful cystic lesions which you see on the jawline and on the chin. And then if you've got hormonal fluctuations, example, if you've got hormonal changes during your menstrual cycles or pregnancy or perimenopause, this also makes women much more susceptible to acne. And, of course, as we said, skincare overloads, when you actually clog the pores with the too much anti-aging or too much heavy moisturizing products, that you actually can't release the sweat from those glands, those pores clog up, and then you trap bacteria and you clog up those pores, that's a problem.
I definitely want to come back to talk about skin products a little bit later on.
Your dietary triggers.
So that's what I was going to say. They always used to say, well, you know, can't eat oily foods, you can't this.
It's not really about oily foods. It's about high-refined carbohydrates. White flour products, a lot of the thick, like sort of fatty dairy foods, those cause increased inflammation and flare-ups.
Okay, so we've spoken about stress, diet, eczema and allergies.
So eczema in the dermatological world is called atopic dermatitis, okay? And eczema and allergies can be from environmental and lifestyle shifts, or can sometimes be from genetics. But if we go back to the hygiene hypothesis that we spoke about a few weeks ago, so if you grow up in an overly sanitized environment, that deprives your immune system of your necessary exposure to all your germs, your microbes, that cause it to overreact to harmless substances like pollen or your pet dander or food proteins. Then you look at things like skin barrier breakdown, where if you use harsh soaps or detergents or frequent bathing strips, the skin, you deprive it of its natural oil, and you allow these allergens and irritants to enter more easily and trigger this eczema. A lot of highly processed diets, decreased vitamin D intake, and of course, even air conditioning can actually cause this type of eczema, because it shifts our microbiomes in our gut and reduces our natural tolerances. And then we've also said before, elevated carbon dioxide levels result in longer, more intense pollen seasons, and that also can worsen your respiratory allergies as well as air pollution. So all these things add up and cause issues.
Melissa says Accutane for acne has been for them a miracle drug.
So Accutane is an excellent drug for acne, but you also got to remember that something like that's got to be monitored in young, fertile women, because you know, you don't want to get pregnant on Accutane, as well as affecting young people. It dries the skin out dramatically, so you can get bleeding, you can get severe like crusting around those areas. You've got to avoid sunlight, you've got to have enough.
So it's a brilliant drug, but it needs a lot of care.
Preambles.
Right. And Anton says, the other Anton says, if you're discussing melanomas about 20 years ago, Dr. Schwartz found and removed a melanoma in situ on my back about an inch from my spine. Not the greatest place, but the fact is it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
And that means...
kudos to the dermatologists.
Absolutely. And to people checking it out. Gut health, can it affect your skin?
Gut health is one of those new, like, you know, we always talk about peptides and GLP-1s and things. Gut health is also up there with all this new sort of regularization. But, I mean, that heavily influences your skin, because we've got what we call the gut-skin axis. So you've got trillions of microbes in your stomach or in your gut area, and those regulate your immune system, those digest your nutrients, and those control inflammation. But when that gut health is actually compromised, it will trigger inflammation, it will affect your hormone levels, and that often shows up as skin issues like acne, eczema, or psoriasis. So your skin, remember, acts as a barrier function. So in your gut, all those microbes, those are also a barrier, because those prevent toxins and undigested food from leaking into your bloodstream. So if this barrier breaks down, then those immune cells react to the particles, and that can cause redness, flare-ups, or rashes. And then also important with that gut bacteria is your nutritional side from the absorption side. You know, your body needs to absorb and synthesize essential vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin D, and various B vitamins. And those are needed for various skin cell turnovers, for hydration and wound healing. And once again, it's also very important in hormone regulation. So there's a lot of like repetition here in what the skin does.
Yes, I see that.
On an endocrinological, it works on a nutritional, it works on a protective and immune barriers. And it's a very important organ for many reasons.
It is 6:20. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. We're speaking about the science of skin. We'll be back with you just after this.
Get down to the Bluebird Shopping Center now. Let us be a part of your journey with your little one and give them all they need with great savings on big brands. Experience a wide range of baby products for every precious moment, from bath time to bedtime and meal times to play times. Baby City has your needs covered. Get to Baby City Athol at the Bluebird Shopping Center for everything you need, from South Africa's leading baby hyper. Baby City, we know you care.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
6:21, Bianca is asking a question that, in fact, I'm going to be asking later, which is there any way to tan in a healthy way? But Bianca, I'm with you. We're going to come back to that question. When I was preparing, I wrote down some of these skin diseases or something, and some of them I can't even pronounce. Rosacea.
Not bad.
Okay, what is that?
So that's a chronic inflammatory skin condition, and that you will see people present with this redness on their skin. Their blood vessels are quite visible, and they've got these like acne-like bumps, more like predisposed on the central area of the face.
But not drinkers.
That's a different story, but that, we'll get to that now. But it's most common in adults aged 30 to 60, and you can generally manage the symptoms with good targeted skincare medications. You get facial redness, you get flushing.
Oh, I can picture now.
So that's why you think it's drinking.
Yes.
You get visible blood vessels. You actually get small broken capillaries. We call them spider veins. Appear on the cheeks and the nose. So it does look like somebody who's got a massive alcohol intake.
Yes.
That, like, you know, like Alex Ferguson. You know?
Yes, exactly.
He gets that red nose. That, I'll also be an alcoholic if I had to support that team. I mean, let's not kid.
Okay, right.
Bumps and pimples that like also present there. And then in the really, really like severe case, and which is more common in men, you see this marked thickening of the skin of the nose, and it enlarges, and it's called a rhinopharma.
So it actually impacts
your skin. Even in severe cases, can cause eye irritation, and you get ocular rosacea. So, I mean, that you get these bloodshot, dry, and swollen eyes. So it's very easy to confuse this with a drunkard.
So what is that from?
So that's also from the hormonal misbalance, and from the estrogen, cortisol, testosterone, all of those things are broken down, and you get the breaking of the capillaries because you get low albumin, you get endothelial dysfunction, and all these things that actually cause this type of breakdown.
And psoriasis?
So psoriasis is an autoimmune disease. Okay.
Oh.
So that's when your skin cells multiply much faster than normal. Now, that's different to cancer, obviously, because the cancers are abnormal skin cells that proliferate or grow at a marked rate. How your skin cells are growing as a way to attack your own body because they don't differentiate. Okay,
so is that why it could be like flaky?
Can be flaky, yes.
Okay.
So you get this thick raised, you get these inflamed patches of skin, and it's almost like it's like a fish, like it's covered in silvery scales. Okay, so it can be itchy, it can be cracked, it can be painful. And the root cause of that is because your immune system actively and mistakenly attacks your healthy skin cells. So that triggers that rampant inflammation in the body, and then we call that rapid cell turnover, okay?
And how do you treat it?
So it's generally with corticosteroids or with creams or with immune modifying drugs like methotrexate. There's a whole lot of things with different types of phototherapies. There's really a vast majority of things, and there's also different types of things. There's, you know, there's plaque psoriasis, there's guttate psoriasis. So psoriasis is a very difficult thing to treat, and it's very common to be found on the elbows, as well as on the knees and the scalp and the lower back.
Is it genetic?
So, you know, it's an autoimmune disease. Not all autoimmune diseases are genetic, but there is a component.
skin microbiomes.
So we were talking about that just now as well. You know, we were talking about the gut skin axis, and that's once again trillions of microorganisms, including bacteria, fungi, viruses, and even little mites that actually live on the surface of your skin, but they're invisible, and they're actually almost like a protective ecosystem that's an extension of your immune system. So they defend your body against pathogens, they help with healing of wounds, and maintain that natural skin barrier. So if you think about it, your skin is not a single environment. It's an extremely diverse landscape which is divided into main zones. So you take your face, your back, your chest, that would be your oily zone. You take your armpits and your groin, that's your moist zone. And you take your forearms and your legs, that's your dry zone. So the microbiome in these areas act in different ways. And they act in with regards to a barrier function, or they give immune sort of communication to the body. And they help with moisture retention. And, you know, you've got common microorganisms that are there commonly. So you can get something called a Staphylococcus epidermidis, which is a common bacteria found on the skin. You get different types of fungi or different types of mites that live near the hair follicles and actually help to remove dead skin cells. And that's why, you know, a lot of the time when you take antibiotics and you get rid of the normal bacterial pathogens in your body, it's not a good thing and could cause other sort of resultant diarrheas or abnormal colitis or changes in your whole gut flora.
And Ansign says, I'm in my 70s. I have a brown marking on the top half of both feet. It looks like henna. Nobody seems to know what it is.
So, look, I mean, when you think of brown markings, especially in female patients, you think of something called melasma, which is like a menopausal hormonal or even pregnancy-related type of change in the skin.
Well, if she's in her 70s, it'll be quite the miracle.
Menopausal, postmenopausal, any hormones.
I was going with pregnancies. I thought there's a story here to be told.
This is 2026. Anything can happen, you know? But also, I mean, a lot of people who, like, you know, a lot of the older generation still clean their own houses. They still do their own handwork. So if you're on your knees all day and you're cleaning the house, and from that point of view, you will get that type of bruising, because remember, the skin is much less elastic. You've got a broken.
So it might even be from, honestly, wearing.
From wear and tear.
From wearing shoes that are too tight.
Well, not on your knees. I mean, that would be really weird.
Top, you know, part of a foot.
Yeah, but even going up to the knees, it's unlikely that you'll get bruising from your shoes or too tight. More you get a deep
I'm going with that. I'm telling you. He listened to me on that, and I didn't even Google it. Okay. Let's move.
Mary Poppins over here.
Let's move on to skin cancer. Are skin cancer rates increasing?
Yeah, I think that's sure. That's definitely a yes, because we've got an increase in our UV light exposure from people going outdoors, from outdoor recreation, from indoor tanning. We've got a much older population. And we've also got a better way of diagnosing, and we've got better diagnostic tools to pick up skin cancers, which previously were unnoticed. So if you look at a mixture of these things, you know, South Africa has one of the highest UV levels in the world, together with Australia. Mm-hmm. So we will have a surge, obviously, then in melanoma and non-melanoma cases in this country. I mean, with that high sort of UV exposure, you've got marked sun damage, which breaks down skin cell DNA over time. If you're using tanning beds, you know, these tanning beds, especially over the last few decades, they've got much higher concentrate levels of UV radiation.
So why do they even make them?
Oh, you know, people think that by looking better, you are
by
healthier.
Looking burnt,
yeah.
You look. Is it true that people like us, Gen X, I suppose, who...
Speak for yourself.
Yes, I am. Who, as kids, would very rarely wear. I mean, we had protection factor two.
Yeah.
That we are much more at risk as we get older because of childhood neglect.
Sure, that's hectic. Childhood neglect, your own childhood neglect. So look,
yes.
I mean, sun protection factor is a very important, you know, necessary thing. So the higher the sun protection factor means the thicker the cream, and you know, but you still need a sun protection factor, whether it's 2, 5, or 10, you still need that thing to help prevent.
Right, but I'm just wondering about the latent impact.
So the impact of being in the sun is that lifelong damage that causes your skin cell DNA to basically, you shorten your telomerases of your DNA, you damage that skin cell, you get more risk for melanoma. So I don't think that being in the sun when you're younger and wearing an SPF 2 is more of a risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more time in the sun itself is the risk factor
right.
itself.
Okay, I get that distinction. So let's talk about, well, first of all, how dangerous are melanomas melanomas melanomas? Or are they different? And how dangerous are they?
So it's the most serious and aggressive skin cancer.
Okay.
And what it happens is it actually develops from something called a melanocyte, and that's a cell that produces melanin.
Mm.
That gives your skin, your hair, your eyes the actual color. So it always occurs, or most often occurs, on sun-exposed skin, but it can also occur and form in the eyes, or the mouth, or in the intestines. And that's why you hear when people get melanoma, they can get in the eyes or in the intestine, etc. Yeah. Okay, so we know that it's less common than other forms of cancer. I mean, if you speak to people, they say they've got a basal carcinoma or a squamous cell carcinoma. You know, we hear about that often. But melanoma itself is far more dangerous and more likely to spread. It's more likely to metastasize to other parts of the body if it's not treated and diagnosed early enough. And the primary cause of that melanoma is, once again, DNA damage to those skin cells. So that's typically caused by that ultraviolet radiation from the sunlight or from your artificial sources like your tanning beds, if you've got a history of frequent blistering sunburns. So people go out into the sun often, like when they first have holiday, and they get that red blistering thing. And you do that frequently over years, you've got a much higher predilection to melanoma. If you've got a family history of melanoma, higher.
So that one is genetic.
Also, fair skin, light hair.
Yes,
fair
exactly.
skin, light hair, light eyes. Mm. And then depending how many moles you've got all over your body, are they atypical looking, etc. And what we do is we look at a grading system. So, you know, a melanoma can often appear as a new, unusual looking spot on your body or a change in the existing, I see you looking at your fingers.
Mm. Well, I'm looking everywhere, freckle. Actually.
And
you're just lucky I'm still
use a grade
keeping
guard,
my shirt
you
on.
Keep your pants on. We use it called the ABCDE guard.
I wrote that down. What is this ABCDE?
So that's a guard to look at melanoma. So A stands for asymmetry. Okay.
Right.
So does one half of the spot actually match the other half of the spot?
Okay.
The B we use is for border, okay? Are the edges irregular? Are they notched? Are they scalloped? Or are they poorly defined? The C is for color. Is the color uniform, or does it include different shades of brown or black or patches of pink or red? And the D is for the diameter. So, you know, how big is the spot? Is it larger than 6 millimeters, which is about the size of a pencil eraser? And although a melanoma can, although be sometimes a lot smaller when it's first detected. And then the E is it evolving? Is it changing in size, shape, color, or elevation? And does it start to bleed, itch, or crust over? So that's very important when you're trying to understand, you know, how dangerous are melanomas and how to look out for them, you know. Okay. Women do self-testing for breast lumps. People should be doing self-testing for melanomas, looking at your moles. And if you can't see your back, get your significant other or your sibling, whatever, to check on your back and take a picture of it and look at it a different late, like a week or two later, to see if there's any changes.
See if it has changed. All right. So coming back to that question that Bianca asked, and I wanted to ask you, is tanning ever safe?
So unfortunately not. Sun tanning is just not safe because it doesn't mean that it's a sign of health. It's your skin's biological response to injury. So when your skin gets exposed to that ultraviolet radiation, you produce more melanin, and that's a defense mechanism which your skin uses to absorb radiation and prevent further DNA damage. In other words, it's already being damaged, and it wants to try and sort of protect itself further, and that's why it goes darker, okay? So any increase in the melanin then shows you that you've got a symptom of cell damage. So there's no such concept as safe tanning.
So if you, let's say you're on holiday and you're spending a lot of time outside, you put on sunblock every day, but over the course of the holiday, you get a bit more color in your skin. Is that bad?
So color's not bad. There's no doubt about it. But once again, everything goes with moderation. So if you go from white to
red,
black dark, that's a problem, you know. If you go from white to a light brown over a course of weeks, that's healthy.
Right. Okay.
And don't forget, importantly, eye damage. Like, you know, you've got to
have a huge thing.
good protection for your eyes because you risk eye damage from melanomas, from radiation to the eyes, cataracts, other forms. So you've got to have good protection for that as well.
Okay. Should everybody have annual skin checks?
Not necessarily. It depends according to which Skin Cancer Foundation, you look at, I mean, if you go to Australia and you see all these guys sitting on Bondi Beach with no umbrellas and no hats, that's the capital of the world of sunburn and melanoma, you know? It's people with high risk. Then they should have their skin evaluated by a dermatologist at least annually or every 6 to 12 months, depending on which category they fall into. In other words, do they have a very personal or family history of skin cancer, being melanoma especially? Do they have fair skin, light eyes or light hair? Do they have a history of blistering sunburns? And do they have more than 50, like, atypical moles over their body?
Mm.
And for average risk individuals with no major risk factors, then you can go every 2 to 3 years for a checkup.
Is a melanoma, is skin cancer curable if detected early, or most of them anyway?
Most skin cancers are, okay? And that's very important. You know, you got to, that's the point of checking for them and getting rid of them, because if you can get skin cancer or melanoma in an early stage, it can be excised. If it's involving a lymph node, that lymph node can be removed, and you can actually be free of any sort of consequences of that.
So I remember reading that there was no universal standard when it came to SPFs and all of these different factors. Yeah. Has that improved?
Yeah, it has. But I think you've got to look at it at two ways, because, you know, we all look at SPF, but what we should be looking at is actually UV index. Because the UV index, which is your ultraviolet index, is a way for us to measure the strength of the sun's sunburn producing radiation. So before you look at, like, how much SPF or sun protection factor you're putting on with the cream, you actually need to look what is the best time of the day to go out into the sun so you'll get the least damage. And obviously, the lower the risk, in other words, from like 0 to 2, is minimal risk of overexposure.
Okay, in Norway,
you can enjoy the time. Depends, okay? And then you can benefit from, like, let's say, a sun protection factor of 15. But when you go to the higher risk, like 6 to 7, let's say, where there's a high risk of sunburn, then you need to be putting on, like, a sun protection factor of 30 to 50 generously. You need to wear proper clothing with it. And that's when your sun exposure is between 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Those are when your UV radiation is much higher. So, you know, people often ask, well, what difference does it make if I use an SPF 50 or an SPF 30, The SPF, the sun protection factor 50, is technically better because it blocks about 98% of your UV rays, okay, compared to the SPF 30, which only blocks 97%. It's a margin of error, the difference, essentially, okay? Because at the end of the day, most people under-apply sunscreen. So most dermatologists will actually recommend an SPF 50.
Right.
Because that's for extended activities outdoors. But for daily, like, normal, like, things where, like, going around, it will be an SPF 30 they'll recommend.
And how often do you need to, obviously, if you're swimming in and out of the water on holiday, that's fine, you understand. Yeah. But how long does it last?
So about 2 hours.
Is that all?
You've got to have a generous application. If you swim, even less.
Yeah, sure.
But I'm at 2 hours, yeah.
Okay. Did we talk about basal cell carcinomas and squamous? I mean, you mentioned those.
I kind of mentioned them, but I think, because remember, we're discussing skin cancer, so melanoma is the most dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But basal cell carcinoma is the most common type of skin cancer. And that comes from the basal cells in the skin, which are found in the lower part of your skin layer, the epidermis. That's the outer layer of the skin. So it typically appears as a slow-growing, pearly, shiny bump, or even a flat, scaly patch. And a lot of people get them on the face, the neck, the nose, and that area. And the most often primary cause of that is extensive UV radiation.
Incredible.
And, I mean, they grow slowly
over
time. And they are highly curable with a very, very low risk of spreading.
Why aren't sunbeds made illegal?
Well, why is cigarette smoking not made illegal? Why is alcohol not made illegal?
It's not the same dependency.
Well, it is.
I don't think.
Well, you're joking.
Yes.
I mean, people are dependent on nicotine. People are dependent on
things. Yes, that one they're dependent on.
You have to get aggressive.
Sunbeds, I don't think they're so dependent on.
Well, it depends if you've got a body, you know, dysmorphic disorder that you have to, like, have this type of glaze or glow every time you go out, then people are dependent on them. People believe that by having a darker color, you look healthier and you look better to other people. So therefore, people go daily for sunbeds. Yeah. Doesn't mean it's allowed. That's good for you.
No, I just don't understand why they're a thing. It's completely unfathomable to me. 061-895-1019. It is 20 to 7. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. We're talking about the science of the skin. If you have any questions, send them in. We'll be back and to talk about skincare, anti-aging, and what works and what doesn't.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
18:41. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg, talking about skin care and the science of skin. Gail wants to know, do artificial tanning products affect the skin?
So artificial tanning products are much better. They don't really affect
the skin.
Is it
that like spray-on?
That spray-on, that self-tan, that type of thing. That's much better than using UV radiation or those UV beds.
Does it not have a cause an actual reaction in the skin? I mean, or is it like a surface?
Surface reaction.
Okay, fine. Right, Gail, hope that answers it. Let's move on to skincare and anti-aging. Do expensive skincare products actually work?
Not necessarily. I mean, you know.
You're saying, you're like answering like you're resentful of these questions.
No, because I'm saying we all take it for granted that these things do, because the more expensive it is, the better it is. But it's actually not necessarily a thing, because a lot of the time, you're actually only paying for luxury packaging when you get these things.
Oh, no, but it's beautiful.
I mean, the marketing, you get that cosmetic elegance which you fall for all the time, you know.
Yes, for sure.
Rather than actually efficacy. And that's the important thing, you know. A lot of the time, that biological working ingredient that's found in affordable things at a same concentration will be as good as the expensive one. So, you know, you've got to look at scientific formulations rather than the price tag, okay? And what you should be saving on, what you should be splurging on. So basic cleansers, daily moisturizers, broad spectrum sunscreens, that you should be saving on. You shouldn't have to go for the over-expensive ones.
A brand name.
What might be worth like spending more money on is like serums containing complex formulations of proven actives like a vitamin C or retinoids, that type of thing. And that can sometimes be worth the investment, but you've got to be using them often.
And you've got to know what you're doing, because so often they use marketing speak to make it sound scientific, and it isn't.
Yeah.
So just to say that again, it was moisturizer, skin cleanser, and sunscreen. Those were the three. And you're saying those don't need to... You don't need to go the most expensive route.
You don't need to go the most expensive route. You can get the affordable brands, because the most of the ones that are fragrance-free, those protect your skin barrier without breaking the bank. And that's, you know, you can use that very easily.
So that's important. And then when we get on to collagen?
So collagen supplements can actually be worth it if you're looking for your moderate improvements in your skin hydration and elasticity, or if you want to seek relief from joint discomfort like osteoarthritis. Mm. So you get a lot of these like tablets that contain collagen or glucosamine, which are very good for osteoarthritis. But you've got to understand that it's not a miracle cure. So they can't replace fundamental lifestyle choices like sun protection, not smoking, balanced diet. But if you do consider taking the collagen, you know, in skin health, a lot of trials actually show that daily supplementation will increase your skin moisture and elasticity, and at the same time reduce appearance of wrinkles over sort of a 6-month period. It's not a replacement for topical skincare like the retinoids or daily sunscreen, but it definitely will help towards it. And there's definitely a lot of studies that show that collagen helps easing joint pain with associated osteoarthritis.
So that's a supplement.
That's a supplement, like in a tablet form. Okay.
Yes.
Because there's limitations, however, because your body breaks down their collagen into amino acids like any other protein. So there's actually no guarantee that supplemental collagen will go directly to your skin or hair.
Which ingredients have the strongest scientific evidence?
So if we look at them, you've got to look at those compounds that are actually able to penetrate the skin and deliver proper changes in your cell function of your skin, your barrier repair, and that collagen synthesis. So the most highly researched ones and those with proven skincare ingredients are things like retinoids. That's retinol, tretinoin. And those are the gold standard of care, especially in dermatology, because those boost your cell turnover, they stimulate collagen, and they treat things like acne and signs of aging. Okay, sunscreen with like zinc oxide on chemical filters, Those are extremely well researched for evidence-based product skin health, and they actually prevent DNA damage, and they help with preventing collagen degradation and reduce the risk of skin cancer. Things like vitamin C. It's a highly potent antioxidant.
It's become quite a, common ingredient
In a lot of your skin, sort of things, that it's a highly potent antioxidant. So it actually protects your skin from that free radicals that are caused by that ultraviolet exposure. And it has been shown to brighten your skin tone or fade a bit of hyperpigmentation and support your body's natural collagen. Then things like niacinamide.
I wanted to ask you about that, because some of the moisturizer I use has this niacinamide in it. But I've got no idea if it's good or not.
Yeah, so it's a versatile vitamin. There's a lot of good data that shows that it helps reduce facial redness, fading red spots on the skin, and not to be confused with niacin, because niacin itself can have bad effects on people. It causes flushing of the skin. It can cause what almost looks like an allergic reaction, but
what is niacin?
So niacin, when we're talking about an oral supplement like niacin, it's also B3, but that can cause actual reddening of the skin and cause reactions that seem to be allergic, in fact, but it's actually not. In fact, during the COVID times, people were taking niacin.
That's what I remember, to try and help
with that, and people were complaining that they actually will find that their skin was going red and hot, and they were wondering if they were having reactions, and it wasn't actually a reaction, it was an effect.
It's just an impact. What is hyaluronic acid?
So even like hydroxy acid or hyaluronic acid. So hyaluronic acid is what we call a humectant molecule, okay? And that holds up your skin to about 1,000 times more of its weight than water. So it actually is superior for hydration.
Wow.
It plumps up the skin and improves your overall texture. And then like hydroxy acid is an exfoliant that helps with backing the skin. It helps dissolve the bonds between the dead skin cells and it makes smoother, brighter skin. I feel like I sound like an advertisement here.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. So I just want to go through retinol. Did we mention retinol?
No. We did mention it, but I'm saying...
But retinol is also an important one.
Retinol is what we said now. That's your gold standard, okay? Because it accelerates your cell turnover, it fades hyperpigmentation, you can follow it up with a broad spectrum sort of sun protection factor because that retinol increases the sensitivity. Okay,
right.
So retinol is a different type of retinoid that penetrates the upper layers of the skin.
So who would use it? Who would use retinol?
So I mean, a lot of people use retinol for wrinkles, for improved texture of the skin, for clearer skin. But you've got to start slow, and you've got to buffer up the skin and protect the eyes and mouth.
And make sure that you protect yourself from the sun.
Yeah.
If that's the case.
Yeah.
Exosomes.
Yeah, so exosomes are almost like, I would say, the new thing, but they're definitely not the new thing because they've been around for a while. But those are actual tiny messengers.
I'm feeling bad because I've never even heard of those.
So those are tiny messenger vesicles, which are naturally released by cells that communicate with other cells. And those promote repair, hydration, and collagen production. So when we use them for skincare, they're used to decrease inflammation, improve your skin texture, and they promote anti-aging. And what they do is they transport proteins and lipids and all genetic material from cell to cell to help effectively give sluggish or aging cells instructions on how to behave younger. They're almost like, I'm going to say this, it's not the same thing, but almost like peptides. You know,
I want to talk
about
peptides.
Messages,
still.
You know,
yeah.
They're really good. They reduce inflammation, they stimulate collagen, they enhance healing. So exosomes are really, really good to try on the skin.
Before we go to a break, I just want to ask you Marilyn's question. Talk about Matrixel, Matrixel.
So look, I mean, we've got to understand that there are a lot of different types of supplements or there are a lot of type of things. And there's Matrix Gel, which might be what we're talking about here, or Matrixel. It's all a cellular organism that we got to understand is being turned over by your DNA in your body. So, you know, you get matrix metalloproteinase and you get all these matrix other different cells in the body that all proliferate, but you got to understand what the right type of cream is and what the right type of effective treatment is for all these things.
All right, Jeff, I see your question. We'll come back to you just after this. 061-895-1019.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
into the last 5 minutes of the show. Jeff asking about creams that contain taro. Not something you're familiar with.
Mm-mm.
Okay, so Jeff, apologies. Not apologies, we're just unfamiliar with that. If you want to let us know what that is.
I know there's a plant, but I don't know much about the taro plant, what it does
for the skin.
Yeah.
Okay. My social media has a lot of people using red light therapy.
Mm.
What is red light therapy? They look like they're wearing this mask.
They are.
And they're trying to make it look cool, but it doesn't look cool.
So red light therapy is when you use a low-level wavelength of a visible red light, and that stimulates cell activity in the skin, so especially within the mitochondria. And it's actually been sort of scientifically proven by a lot of dermatology societies and health societies. It's non-invasive, and it helps reduce the fine lines on the skin, soothe inflammation, and boost collagen production. So it's used in anti-aging, in acne reduction, in wound scarring and healing. The ones you're talking about, the at-home ones, like the LED masks, are very popular for daily or weekly use, but they take very long to show results because you need to use them multiple times for up to 4 to 6 months to get the results that you would use in the much higher-powered treatments
for that?
That you can use at actual labs.
Are we dead by then? Yeah. Okay, so the at-home ones, the ones that you're using at homes, not showing
as much benefit as the, obviously the ones
right.
with higher power.
I just want to, in the few minutes we have left, to talk about Botox, fillers, peptides, really about the future of aesthetics.
Yeah.
Aesthetic medicine seems to have become mainstream.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's become minimally invasive. A lot of it is non-surgical. So you've got a lot of injectables and laser therapies that give quick results, and there's almost zero downtime. So it's become much more mainstream because social media has normalized it. There's been a pivot towards these natural-looking like results, and that makes it much more sort of accessible to get these cosmetic enhancements. So as I said, you get this minimal downtime, you get technological advancements, and you get this natural looking result from using these things.
So and peptides?
So I mean, we know my love for peptides, but I mean, especially when you're speaking about the skin, a very popular one for the skin is the GHKCU, which is the copper peptide.
I heard it hurts.
So there's two. Okay. There's the cream and there's the injectable one.
Right.
There's also tablets, but I mean, the bioavailability and absorption of the tablets isn't great, okay? So the cream is very highly effective to use on the face, okay?
Right.
Helps with the smoothing of the face. It brings out a nice color. It helps the wrinkles. Excellent. The subcutaneous, the injection, is also excellent because it's anti-inflammatory. It's got antioxidant. It helps with tissue repair, anti-aging. And I've got a lot of patients that tell me that when they're taking the injection, it helps with their hair growth. It helps with their nail growth. Their skin looks better. And yes, it does hurt when you inject it. Remember, these things are kept in the fridge. And the way to mitigate that is you take it out of the fridge, you let it come back to room temperature, and you inject it much slower. And you do get a reaction from it. You get a histamine release from that type of peptide, so you can get a welt around that area and a bit of itching, but that generally dissipates and subsides over time.
So in terms of peptides, is that the main one?
That's the best one for skin.
Right. Okay. And other, you know, Botox, fillers, those seem to be as extremely effective in helping people with anti-aging.
No doubt about it. I mean, Botox fillers, you know, they always get asked the question, when is it the right age to use Botox? So we know that in the early 20s is not the right age, but late 20s, early 30s, from there on, is a very good time to start using it. You don't become addicted to it. It helps your body with the wrinkles. It's almost preventative.
I was just going to say, does it slow it down?
It stops those fine lines from permanently etching into your skin. So we said when people use it for mild frowns or for crow's eyes, that actually like appear when you make those facial expressions.
I know
that's where it's needed.
I think it's also needed in newborns. They are very wrinkly. And I can tell you a lot of them could do with some nice Botox and fillers.
So fillers are even becoming safer than they were before because they're using a lot more hyaluronic acid. And they've got much stricter regulations, who can actually do the fillers and when it should be given. They've got better materials. There's even a way to reverse them if there's damage from them with these newer medications. So, I mean, a lot of things are happening. The one big thing that you got to worry about with fillers is what you get, we call it a vascular occlusion. And that's if the filler actually can be injected into a blood vessel, it will block the blood flow. And if you don't treat that, it can lead to tissue like death as well as blindness. So you've got to be very careful.
Wow. Okay, so final question as we wrap up. What do you think skincare is going to look like in 10 years' time?
So I think we're entering, once again, a world of things that we don't even understand how it works with, from stem cells to slowing skin aging to polypeptides to artificial intelligence to having blood tests to actually thing. I think that we are basically changing the whole skincare thing. So you're going to have AI and DNA personalization where generic one-size-fits-all routine will be obsolete. Everyone will be able to do their own home scanners, DNA testing. You'll be able to have skincare with, you know, your own mitochondria helping regenerate your skin.
Absolutely.
We will slow down that inflammaging, which we talk about, you know. You'll have advanced at-home devices. You'll have what we call skin minimalism, you know, where you'll be able to multitask your skin from a 10-step routine. You'll have microbiome and adaptogenic support. So there's so many different things that are going to happen in the next few years with skincare.
It's an incredibly exciting field. That is where we do need to leave it. Thank you, as always, Dr. Anton Meiberg. Thank you all for your questions, for your comments. Jeff, I see that it isn't a tallow. It is, it's tallow, not a tarot. I appreciate you messaging us about that. Yeah. I greatly appreciate it. Have a fantastic evening. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning for the Morning Mayhem, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Don't be late. This has been your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg.